At Ability Chiropractic, we believe every child deserves to grow up healthy, strong, and connected to the incredible power within their own body. From infants to adults, our doctors specialize in purposeful chiropractic care that restores balance between the brain and body, helping you and your family live and heal the way you were designed to, naturally. Families across Columbus are choosing to build lifelong wellness from the start. Discover what true health feels like at Ability Chiropractic. Schedule your visit today at abilitychiro.com.
Finding pregnancy support you can trust is worth celebrating. Getting it on sale is worth belting Beyonce in your car. That's right. Ritual's Black Friday sale is on. Support your body's new nutrient needs with their clinically backed prenatal multivitamin. Or give back to your gut with Natal Biotic, a probiotic supplement for trying, pregnancy, and postpartum to support digestive, vaginal, and baby's immune health. At Ritual, quality is top priority. All of their supplements are clean, third-party tested for heavy metals, and 100% made traceable. Because you deserve high-quality support at every stage of your pregnancy journey. Cut prices without cutting corners and get their best savings on their best supplements with 40% off your first month for a limited time at ritual.com/pregnancy support. These statements have not been evaluated by the Food and Drug Administration. This product is not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any disease.
Let's talk. John Brown. Winston and the Windsors, how Churchill State shaped a royal dynasty. There have been many biographies of Winston Churchill and many volumes of members of the royal family, but there's none that's actually charted the relationship between the two. Andrew Morton, who you may have heard of before, he's esteemed for his biographies, of course, of the royals, has written the new book, Winston and the Windsors, and joins us now. Andrew, good morning to you.
Morning. Nice to talk to you.
It's great to have you back on Talk Radio Europe. I find it fascinating that nobody has written a book about the relationship, because if you think of that defining period of British history, you know, you think about the Blitz, you think about, you know, the, you know, King George and the Queen Mother, or the Queen as she was then, walking through a blitzed out London, and you think of Churchill in London as well, and you would have thought that people would have written about this. No, but no.
Well, exactly. I mean, and what I realized is that there's never been a politician or a statesman who's actually shepherded a dynasty, not just a reign, but a dynasty throughout his life. I mean, you know, Churchill comes into the scene in a big way with the presentation of the Cullinan Diamond to the royal family. He helped to organize that. That was in 1907. And then, towards the end of his career, he's advising the Queen Mother to return to public duties because she wanted to go into retirement. So, and then in between that, you've got the abdication, you've got World War II, and a host of other things where Churchill is central to this to the issues. So he's been around. I mean, and he's had a up and down relationship with the royal family. Prince of Wales, not King Charles, but the previous one who became Duke of Windsor, once referred to him as a swine. Others called him a cad. He was blamed for the premature death of, as they saw it, of Edward the Seventh. So he wasn't favourite for high tea at Buckingham Palace.
Yeah, something tells me that, Churchill, with his ideas of duty and country, wasn't exactly going to be the biggest, as we call, fanboy of what would become the Duke of Windsor. If you think about the time period, though, I mean, you mentioned, 1907. So that's, that's Edwardian through to, and through to the mid-60s when he died. So that's the new, that's the new Edwardian age, isn't it? And the world, Britain, the world has changed in those 50 years. The world has changed, unbelievably quickly.
Well, he was one of the instigators of plane flight, flight had only just been discovered, as it were, when he first went to Parliament. So he shepherded in the nuclear age. radio, television. I mean, he opposed the televising of the Queen's coronation back in 53. He lost that argument with Prince Philip, actually, and he and Philip had a fairly, again, robust relationship. But he became a lot, far more than just a politician seeing the monarch every Tuesday for a 30-minute chat. He became a father figure, a surrogate uncle, somebody who was there to be a shoulder to lean on, a shoulder to cry on, someone who the royal family turned to for advice and for consolation and he was their go-to guy.
Presumably because he was around for so long. I mean, I know he was there during tumultuous events, but if you look at it, I mean, he's practically part of the furniture, isn't he? You know, standing next to the occasional tables and the writing bureau because, you know, he's going to be this eminence grease behind the arras.
Well, it's a very good point you make. I mean, I was at a place called Houghton Hall. It's a beautiful stately home, slammed next door to Sandringham. And on their grand piano, because you can do a little tour around, on their grand piano, there was a series of pictures of members of the Cholmondeley family who own it in their coronation robes with the Queen, with Prince Philip and the rest of it on Coronation Day. Guess what was the picture that was central on the grand piano? A picture of Churchill. And I thought to myself, you know, if you enter another stately home and you had pictures of the Queen and surrounded by, say, Margaret Thatcher or Tony Blair, you think that's really odd. But this seemed appropriate. And in a way, Churchill himself became something of a monarch, didn't he? I mean, when the congregation gathered for the wedding of Elizabeth and Philip in 1947, he entered Westminster Abbey last, and spontaneously the whole congregation stood up. Mm. So it was kind of like I wouldn't say a rival king, but certainly he was treated like a deity.
You see, you've anticipated my next question, because if you think about it, with the background that Churchill comes from, you know, and Chartwell and the history
of his,
exactly, and Blenheim and all that sort of thing, and perhaps he can approach the rules still with deference, but you know, he's not a chamberlain. He's not an Attlee. He is obviously knows it's the same standing as the monarch. But you see where I'm coming from with this. He has a gravitas to his bearing.
Well, I mean, unlike Queen Elizabeth and Princess Margaret, he was born in a palace. They were born in a house. So, you know, he was used to grand designs, as it were, and he was someone who he was the first person with his who was non-royal with his head on or image on a postage stamp. I got some money out of the bank the other day, and who was on the cover? Churchill. So he's always with us, and it was interesting. I found that one of the first artifacts that Trump put into the Oval Office was a bust of Churchill. So he's a man who's transcended his time period, and he's still relevant today.
Because that's the icon, isn't it? That's the icon of Chip. But he's much more complex, because I doubt that the president of the United States knows this, but you know, Churchill was in the wilderness for a very long time. He was unpopular, you know. He was seen as a warmonger in the 30s before. You know, he was there rattling away, talking about, you know, the coming storm and all that. But until war broke out, I mean, he was seen as this sort of radical throwback to the Boer War, of course, where he saw service and was captured.
Yeah, good point. I mean, he was very much seen in the 30s as yesterday's man, somebody who was no longer relevant. He opposed the Conservative Party, of which he was a member, over the India policy, about the plans to make India independent. He wanted India to remain this jewel in the Empire's crown. At the same time he was arguing that, he was also arguing about German rearmament, which he was concerned about. But he was a lone voice crying in the wilderness for much of the 1930s, and he was seen as something of an irrelevance. And when he made a speech, which the king didn't like, the king would be consoled by others, people like, you know, Baldwin and so on, saying that, you know, he didn't get any support in the House of Commons.
Let's start there. Let's go back. Is the royals, I mean, we're not just talking about his prime ministerial career. I mean, Edward VII, we talk about, you know, his you know, how he comes into the royal orbit, as it were, as a young man. And we start in 1907, do we? I mean, Edward VII, I mean, tell me a little bit about how he interacts with the king.
Well, actually, the king used to boast that if it wasn't for him, Churchill would never have come into the world, because Churchill's father, Lord Randolph Churchill, fell in love with Jenny Jerome, the daughter of a New York businessman, on board the royal yacht, and the match was opposed by Randolph Churchill's family, the Marlboroughs. They had utter contempt and they're quite snobbish. They just felt that he was marrying below himself. And then when the Prince of Wales, or Tum Tum, as he was called.
Tum Tum. Tum Tum. Right, okay.
Tum Tum, as he was nicknamed. When he interceded and said that it was a very good match, collapse of objections from the relatives. So he was able to marry Jenny Jerome. And of course, within 7 months, 7-8 months, Churchill was born in a storm at Blenheim Palace. So right from the start, he was involved with the royal family, and Blenheim Palace itself was a gift from Queen Anne to John and Sarah Churchill for their work with the monarchy, and also for his brilliant military strategy that won the Battle of Blenheim in 1704. So even as a child, Churchill would, you know, be playing English versus French. He was very much a loved the military life, and he joined he couldn't wait to join the military, and he took part in the last ever cavalry charge at Omdurman and he said it was the most exciting and dangerous 2 minutes of his life, because they charged into an ambush. He was lucky to survive, but he always felt, as you know, as many have observed, that he walked with destiny. Mm. So he kind of the bullets always missed him, and even during the First World War, where he signed up as an officer, and he gave up his military career. He was writing for newspapers, and he wrote his first book about a military campaign, and then he went into Parliament. And all the time, you mentioned it wasn't just about politics. Edward VII was an avuncular father figure. Mm. He was writing him letters. He really took his part, and he was dismayed when Churchill left the Conservative Party in 1904 over tariffs. He didn't didn't like tariffs one bit. He was a great believer in free trade. So he left the Conservative Party, walked across the floor of the House of Commons, and joined the Liberals, sat next to Lloyd George. And then this period of intense radicalism, where he argued for greater social measures from the government and less spending on military, really stopped him enjoying a closer relationship with Edward VII.
I'm just thinking as well, but I'm just going, you know, Edward VIII, of course. I mean, that's, you know, brief, the abdication crisis of 36. I mean, you can see that perhaps, ironically, isn't it? Because if you think of, you know, Churchill is born because his mother's American and Wallace Simpson is American, okay, she's a divorcee, which is a huge thing back in, you know, 90 years ago. You can see why Churchill was so thunderstruck and, you know, and enraged by this, because he is a man who puts duty for his country first. It's in his DNA. You know, his family have always served monarchy, and he can't get his head around the fact that somebody would abdicate from the greatest role in the kingdom.
Absolutely. I mean, and Churchill wasn't alone in this. It's the one connecting dot with Roosevelt, Hitler, Mussolini, Stalin, obviously Churchill. They all thought it utterly unthinkable that a man who enjoyed, by his own admission, a platonic relationship with this twice-divorced American would give up the greatest empire the world has ever seen to marry her. I mean, Churchill, just like a man of the world he was, and he never moralised, by the way. He just felt that Edward VIII should go ahead with his coronation and at some point in the future announced that he was marrying Wallace. And it would have taken a very brave prime minister to have said, well, you can't do it. This is after he'd been crowned. And, you know, you see a similar kind of trajectory with Charles, or King Charles now, and Queen Camilla, that when Charles initially separated from Diana, the talk was of possibly what's called a morganatic marriage, that is to say, where you don't take the full title. He would have been King Charles and the Duchess of Cornwall, yeah, which he was for a long time. And go back to the 30s, and, you know, Churchill was flabbergasted, as was everybody else, that the king was prepared to give up his throne. I mean, it was just literally unthinkable that he would give up his throne for this woman who couldn't even really bear, she was too old to bear him children at that point in her life. So, yeah, and yet he took an enormous blow politically, because he stood up for Edward. He said to his friends, I see it as my duty to stand up for the king. And he was howled down in the House of Commons for arguing for more, to give the king more time to make his mind up. So, you know, what political capital he had was spent on the king, and well, to no avail.
So George VI comes in, awkward, not expecting the role. And it's not, because obviously we will obviously think, as I started this interview by saying, we think of those two sort of working in partnership during, you know, the darkest hours, etc. But apparently it wasn't a relationship that started sort of convenient, you know, it wasn't convivial from the very off. It was quite hard work to begin with.
It was very hard work. I mean, let's face it, the king was desperate for Lord Halifax to accept the role. He was seen as a steady pair of hands. He was seen as, I mean, this aquiline, blue-blooded character who was very much one of them, where the life's glittering prizes had landed in his lap. He'd never fought for them. Churchill, a very different kind of character, ambitious, used his elbows to get to the front, wasn't afraid of pushing himself forward. Very kind of that half American aspect of him was very much there to the fore. He was, you know, a bit like a kind of an American tycoon, just pushy and ambitious, wore his ambition on his sleeve. And obviously the abdication crisis had placed Churchill in the position of supporting Edward VIII, the Duke of York, and the rest of the royal family totally opposed Wallace Simpson becoming queen, and they opposed her having any kind of honour throughout the rest of her life. And so those first few weeks Well, it was very much a shotgun marriage between Churchill and George VI. But they both realised that as Britain was basically hanging on by their by its eyebrows with regards to the Nazi threat of invasion, they had to make it work. And very soon, Churchill realised that he could trust George VI completely. And you see a relationship where George VI was eager and happy to share the burden of secrecy that surrounded so many decisions that Churchill made. I mean, he knew about the Enigma machine, for example, that top secret decoding machine that was at Bletchley. He was told about the development of the nuclear bomb. So the in the very heavy burden that Churchill had during the Second World War, the king was there to provide some comfort and a consult, almost like the confessional.
I was just going to say, I just hadn't thought of that before, because obviously he's got, Churchill's got his wife who is with him all the time supporting, but, you know, and not to get all 21st century and woke on you, but he hasn't got a male friend, because he can't tell his cabinet colleagues because they're all politicians and we know what they're like. So presumably the king was a sounding board, and in the same way, the king could, you know, help share the burden or get involved as and when needed, Andrew.
Yeah, absolutely. But don't run away with the idea that it was all cosy. They fell out over several issues, and you know Churchill took a few liberties. I mean, they're probably the most best known is that when the D-Day landings were first thought of or organized when during the organization for it, Churchill announced that he was going to go on board HMS Belfast and join and in the thick of the fighting. And when he told the king this, he thought, the king thought, that's a good idea. Maybe I'll join you too.
Good grief. What could possibly go wrong?
The Queen said, yeah, that's not a bad idea. Yeah, go ahead. And then the private secretary, Tommy Lascelles, this old stick in the mud, got to hear about it. And he told the king in no uncertain terms that it would be ridiculous. You putting yourself in danger? Do you want your eldest daughter to be saying, who can I appoint as prime minister? Because I'm now the queen, because my father lies at the bottom of the ocean. So he was dissuaded from taking part. And then he tried to dissuade Churchill, but Churchill was adamant. And even though the king wrote him several letters and pleaded with him to the top brass, Eisenhower and all the other generals and field marshals, they were all very much opposed to this plan. In the end, Churchill gave way, but he did so very churlishly and argued that as a minister, he should be able to decide where and when he went without being told by the king. So there was a genuine conflict there, but when you compare that to when Churchill lost the election in 1945, the king was virtually in tears, and he wrote him several very affectionate letters. It was a real bromance.
The relationship between Churchill and Elizabeth, though, is perhaps the defining one. It is the one that perhaps we think of because, as I said before, he's almost part of the furniture. And there's this young woman suddenly thrust... And she is young, and she is thrust into running the empire, basically. She's not prepared for it. She's over in Africa, and her father dies. There is a special relationship between those two, isn't it? This new Elizabethan age, as they were calling it.
Well, Churchill called it a new Elizabethan age, yes. And you just think about it. The Queen has known Churchill for all of her life. You know, when she was a baby, when she was two, Churchill first met her at Balmoral and thought that she had an air of authority about her. But it was kind of nerve-wracking. I mean, Churchill's first reaction after the king died was, she's nothing but a girl. You know, he was quite kind of dismissive. And for the, as far as the Queen was, new Queen was concerned, here was this man, war leader, great friend of George VI, Nobel Prize winner, great orator, you know, and he's bowing to her. So the relationship was got off to a nervy start, but very soon Churchill came to realise that beneath her youth and youthful beauty was a very smart and very level-headed woman who got on top of her brief, read the red boxes, the famous red boxes, very quickly. And she also had this kind of habit of when she was making a decision, she'd look out of a window at the palace for a few seconds. Then she'd come back and say, this is the decision I've made. And Churchill said that this was not, most of the decisions were spot on. And the audiences, which started for 30 minutes, very soon ended up at like an hour and a half. And Churchill would emerge from these audiences with tears rolling down his cheeks, saying, she's just a splendid woman. They would talk about the pleasures of the turf. They were both racehorse owners, and they both knew an awful lot about horse breeding and horse racing.
Well, I mean, did you get the information from primary sources? I've only got a minute and 50, Andrew. I could talk to you this until Friday. So primary sources, I mean, how do you get the information for this particular tome?
Oh, I spent most of the summer before last at Cambridge University, where the Churchill archives are kept, going through all the letters and the correspondence and the newspapers and, you know, all the stuff that you need to write a book like this. Which, and as Eric Larson, the famous American writer, says, it's low hanging fruit. I mean, you pick all this information, but it's also, he's trying to make sense of it as well. I'm trying to make it interesting, and trying to get the thing that Churchill, the man, was different to Churchill, the politician. He was a father figure to the royals, and he was also someone who guided and advised the dynasty, not just the reign, but the dynasty through the 20th century.
The book is called Winston and the Windsors, How Churchill Shaped a Royal Dynasty. It's by Andrew Morton, who we're speaking to today. You can, of course, order the book via our own virtual bookstore. And it is relatively easy, I'd imagine, Andrew, to find you online. But is there an official website? Where can people find you?
Oh, Michael O'Mara Books.
Wonderful. The book is called Winston and the Windsors. It's by Andrew Morton. Andrew, it's been an absolute pleasure to speak to you this morning.
My pleasure too. I enjoyed it. Thank you very much.
At Ability Chiropractic, we believe every child deserves to grow up healthy, strong, and connected to the incredible power within their own body. From infants to adults, our doctors specialize in purposeful chiropractic care that restores balance between the brain and body, helping you and your family live and heal the way you were designed to, naturally. Families across Columbus are choosing to build lifelong wellness from the start. Discover what true health feels like at Ability Chiropractic. Schedule your visit today at abilitychiro.com.
COTA has turned up the frequency. Buses are running more often across Central Ohio. Starting this September, you'll see expanded weekend service on the east and north sides, including the Easton and Polaris corridors. Plus, there are added weekday trips downtown from New Albany, Canal, Winchester, and Tuttle. It's more service, more connections, and more ways to move across the city. Discover the enhanced schedule at coda.com/service changes. That's coda.com/service changes.
At Pluralsight, we don't just teach skills. We are building the tech workforce who deliver results fast, accelerated by top-tier content. Lead with confidence. Lead with expertise. Visit us at Pluralsight.com to tap in and learn more.